Cal Ripken Jr. joins us on Sports Byline. You know, the saying is records were made to be broken, and that may be, but a couple of baseball records I'm sure that will never be broken. Johnny Vandermeer's back-to-back no-hitters and Cal Ripken Jr.'s record for consecutive games played, 2,131, will not be broken as well. This is the 25th anniversary of Cal setting that record, and he joins us on Sports Byline. Cal, first of all, you've had 25 years to put that accomplishment into perspective and to appreciate it. Personally, what do you appreciate the most about setting that record?
I always go back to, they were asking me some of these questions when you were going through it or when I was still playing. How do you want to be remembered and all that kind of stuff? And I told them, I go, at some point in my life, I will sit in a rocking chair and I'll sit on a torch swing and I'll reflect on all the good things that happened. But right now, I don't know. So I am at that point where I'm sitting on a rocking chair and I'm thinking back on all the things. The anniversary of 21-31, it was one of the most remarkable nights. And it was magical in many ways. You know, it was a combination of opening day, playoff baseball. There was another element of with the president being there and all that kind of stuff that made it different. And I think playing out that game, when you think back on it, it was really surreal. Sometimes I think that really happened to me. Was that just some sort of a dream that you had? But all the emotions that came out in that game, you know, they were real. You know, the interaction between myself and my dad up in the skybox, the lap around the ballpark, shaking hands, talking to all the California Angels, including, you know, classy Rod Carew, that I thought was really cool. So when I think about it, sometimes I think of it, but as a personal moment, a human moment. But the baseball was pretty good, too.
I know where I was. I was in New Orleans getting ready to do a football game, broadcast a football game, and I happened to walk around a bar and to put my head in, and I saw you taking the lap around, so I knew what it was. And I just wondered, when you did, was there any one thing that went through your mind? Because, I mean, that to me touched me, and that's the thing I'll always remember. What about for you?
Yeah, the lap is what everybody remembers. There was a 22-minute ovation in the middle of the game when the game became official. Chris Berman not saying a word for 22 minutes was what some people laugh about. And I think that was kind of planned to kind of let the moment unfold all to itself without any words. And there was a lot going on in that moment. There's no way that anyone could have planned for that lap. You know, that was an idea, I think, that first came out of Rafael Palmeiro's mouth, and then Bobby Bowe jumped in. I think Jeffrey Hammond jumped in. And then before I knew it, I was being pushed down the line and started that lap. And at first I thought, okay, maybe this will work. Let me run around there really quickly. But then as soon as you start seeing people, the celebration went from, you know, 40-some thousand people strong in the stadium to a one-on-one sort of encounter. You got to look into the faces of some people you knew, your eye to eye, your hand to hand, and it was a really cool, you know, special moment. So when it started out, thinking, okay, let's see if we can get the game started again by doing this. After a few minutes, I thought, well, I don't care if the game ever gets started. This is a really cool experience.
Was there a critical moment in that whole run of games during the course of your career that was really important for you to be able to continue and get to that record number?
You know, it's still hard for people to believe that that wasn't my goal as a baseball player, was to break Lou Gehrig's record, even though when the streak was created, and I will say it was created by a series of managers that wrote my name in the lineup. You know, they have a decision to make each and every day, you know, what's the best lineup I can put on the field to help us win today? And I was always on that lineup card. They wrote my name in. So when the streak started to get some sort of attention, I guess when it got close to 1,000 games, people started to look at that perspective. I tell you what, it went through a negative period. We went through a major rebuilding process. My dad got fired, you know, as being the coach. There were lots of ups and downs, but I didn't want it to change my approach that I'd always had. It was my job was to come to the ballpark ready to play. And as the manager chose me, I played. So when people think about it, they sometimes think I was obsessed with that. But I think it was more the principle of being an everyday player and having your team count on you to be in the lineup every day. That's what my dad, told me. And I do remember that lesson when I was in the minor leagues. I got hit with a pitch in the back of my hand. I was struggling a little bit. I was sore. I was in a little bit of a slump. And I said, I probably could use a couple days off to heal and kind of get my mind right. And my dad said, he goes, yeah, you could do that. He said, or you got to think about this. The person that replaces you in the lineup, what if he gets 3 hits tonight? He said, guess what the manager's going to do tomorrow? He's going to play him again. He said, what if he does well again? He said, don't let that guy get 3 hits. So in many ways, there were some territorial issues that you had at guarding your own position and being an everyday player. But Dad was pretty adamant. He's, get out there and play. You can't do anything from the bench. Even if you're not feeling well, it can just be one at bat. You can turn it around. And he was a firm believer in a lot of the intangibles that certain players brought to the team. Like, I will tell you, Eddie Murray had this huge presence, this intangible value that even if he was 0 for 50, which I know he never went 0 for 50, but if he was 0 for 50, hitting fourth as a switch hitter in the middle of our lineup made all of us relax, made all of us feel like we could stay in our lane. And I guarantee you, the third time up, when the manager had to make a decision on the pitcher, Eddie Murray was a factor in that decision all the time. And those kind of values are not measured, per se, in the stats, but they're really a valuable thing for your ability to compete each and every day.
Cal, I know I've said this to you before. When I was back in Washington, D.C., covering sports back there, I think as I look back on my career, I think of one of the most enjoyable moments. We're sitting on the bench in the dugout with your dad talking baseball. Tell me a little bit about how he got into the game.
He had two older brothers that played baseball. When I say older brothers, one was, I think, 18 years older than he was, and one was like 9. So there was almost a 10-year split, between kids. And Uncle Bill, his middle brother, both are really good baseball players. Uncle Bill played in the Dodgers system for 4 or 5 years, and then I think he quit at AAA to go get married and become a banker. But Dad was hanging around his older brothers and played baseball, got drafted, or got signed with the Orioles, and he was a catcher. And kind of an undersized catcher if you look at him. And they got hurt with 2 foul balls off his right arm, and he couldn't throw. And so at that time, he had a family and a few kids. They offered him a position to coach, and his then dreams went from making it to the big leagues to helping other people make it to the big leagues. So he was a manager in the minor leagues for the first 14 years, got called to the big leagues as a coach. He had a brief opportunity to manage, which I didn't think it was a really good opportunity because we were totally in a rebuilding sort of mode when he got the chance to be the manager. But he was a great baseball guy, very loyal, hard worker. And we used to call him the jack of all trades. And he would laugh. He'd go, yeah, the jack of all trades, master of none. Because he knew how to build a house. He knew how to fix a car. All the things that he worked at different jobs when he was younger. And even when they built the spring training complex in Key Biscayne, Florida, he was out there, he was coaching burn during the day and then on a tractor building fields at night. So, he was a dedicated baseball guy, very analytical, and a really fantastic teacher.
Yeah, it's interesting because I know he said to your mother one time that your questions about baseball were better than the ones the reporters had asked. And at the age of 3, it's reported that you knew you wanted to be a ball player. Is that true?
At the age of 3?
That's what it said.
I remember, I don't have a lot of memory from 3 years old, but I love being around baseball. And I know I had a glove probably in my crib. It was early on, but I used to have a chance to go to the ballpark with Dad. I think when I was old enough, and I remember 10 being a magic age, where he said, you can come to the ballpark with me. In order to be on the field, you got to put a uniform on. So we had a small little uniform for me, and I had to understand how dangerous it was to be out there with professionals hitting balls. So he let me shag balls in the outfield all the way back to the winning track. He said, I don't want you to try to catch them. If they go to the wall, go over there and pick them up and then give them to somebody else so they can throw them in. So it was fun being around it. But I do remember at 10 years old in Asheville, North Carolina, I think, I was bat boying. And I remember thinking, man, this is a great job. These guys come out here and play every single day. And that was at Double-A. So my dreams was to be a Double-A player at first. Because I just thought it was the greatest thing in the world. You got to play for a living, and it was a great game. So I had a wonderful upbringing in and around baseball. I used to say Dad was the encyclopedia of baseball because he had all this knowledge and he had all this experience. He could talk hitting, pitching, whatever else. Because in those days, you didn't have specialty coaches. He was every one of those coaches when he managed in the minor leagues. And I also had small little books around me in the form of the players that I could ask Doug DeSensei about how to field a ground ball, how to backhand, how to do those sorts of things. And so I felt really thankful that I had all this, all these resources that satisfied my curiosity. I was a kid that asked a lot of questions.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about what you learned from Doug DeSensei.
What's interesting is, I will tell you, so if I was talking to an outfielder and he was saying the way you field a fly ball is you want to play it off to the side here and catch it one-handed. You know, you can make a good case fundamentally now with the gloves that they have that might be the right way. But Dad's way of teaching was it was off your right side, off your right shoulder. You had both hands up, you know, and you could track the ball all the way into your glove. And so if somebody told me that, I'd go ask my dad. You know, he told me I should catch the fly ball one-handed. And he goes, no, that's not right. And then I would X that player off my list. So if Doug DeSensei told me, okay, here's the basic way to field a ground ball. You know, you want your feet a little bit wider apart. You want to bend, you know, at your knees. Get your butt down so your head stays up and catch the ball out front. I would come back and tell my dad that that's what Doug DeSensei said. He said, very good. That's really, he told you the right things. So then I would go back and bug Doug DeSensei. You know, I would do that as a good resource to get from. So Doug was really interesting because ultimately I ended up, I don't know if it was me forcing the trade, but the Orioles traded Doug DeSensei to make room for me at third. Then ultimately Earl moved me to short. So, you know, maybe we should have kept Doug DeSensei and then just put me to short. But it was really interesting. Doug always looked out for me. Doug gave me a glove or two in his time. And he took extra time to kind of play with me and explain things to me. So I'm always thankful to have that relationship with Doug.
We have about 90 seconds, and I know you're passing it on forward with the Cal Ripken Senior Foundation, which I think is just a wonderful organization. You're building ballparks. I know you're about to break ground on your 100th park. Tell me briefly about that.
Yeah, I mean, we tried to capture the spirit of Dad. You know, we lost Dad. He was 63 years old. He was a heavy smoker, died of lung cancer. And so we wanted to say, what was the legacy of Dad's life? And it was helping kids. You know, and he did that professionally when he was in the minor leagues to help kids fulfill their big league dreams. But he also did special clinics, you know, in the different cities he was in. And the secret wasn't about trying to teach baseball to these kids. It was actually to give them the values of sport, to create mentorships and help them go in a positive direction. So we started the foundation in Dad's name, and we do just that. We take our baseball knowledge and our skills into some pretty tough areas in the community. We use it as an icebreaker to get in front of them and encourage them and really make friends. And then we have programs like our Badges for Baseball program, which matches law enforcement with the communities because law enforcement wants a better rapport with the community, and community wants a better rapport with the police officer. So we teach them a little baseball. They trade off of that, and they become mentors, and they're looked up upon in the communities, not as police officers necessarily, but as coaches. And coaches have interesting relationships with kids, and they can really affect their paths in life. And so we've had really good success, and I would have never guessed that we hired a great executive director. We have a national board. We're everywhere, and we're helping a lot of kids. But we started out just in the spirit of Dad, helping one kid at a time.
Cal, like with your father, I always enjoyed every conversation with him, and I've always enjoyed every conversation with you as well. You're welcome here anytime, and I hope you will come back because there's so many more things I'd like to talk to you about your career and about your life. Please do so.
Okay.
Cal Ripken Jr. with us here on America's Sports Talk Show.